This is 2011, the year in review from Brownfield Ag News. I'm Tom Stever. In yet another example of the political gridlock in Washington, we saw the creation of and failure of the Budget Supercommittee. Here's more from Brownfield's Bob Meyer.
It all started out with a rather routine attempt to raise the federal debt ceiling, something Congress has done 73 times since 1962, including 18 times under Ronald Reagan, 8 times under Bill Clinton, 7 times under George W. Bush, and twice so far under President Barack Obama. But as the pressure increased on Congress to do something about the federal debt, a dispute arose over raising the ceiling. Republicans wanted to offset the increase with spending cuts. Democrats wanted to offset it with a combination of spending cuts and increased taxes. While neither side budged from their position, the government headed towards a shutdown. Congress passed the Budget Control Act of 2011 on August 2nd. As part of that deal, a 12-member bipartisan supercommittee would be formed, charged with finding cuts to reduce the federal debt by $1.2 to $1.5 trillion over 10 years. As the supercommittee gathered comments and suggestions as to what should and should not be cut, leadership of both the Senate and House Agriculture Committees decided to basically write the 2012 Farm Bill and submit that as a plan for agriculture policy in the supercommittee report. In early November, 27 members of Congress sent a letter to the supercommittee expressing their objections to a secret farm bill. Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind authored that letter.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about them inserting new support programs in it, which will cost money, when that defeats the purpose of the supercommittee. And that's why I sent the letter to the supercommittee saying, listen, your task is to try to find long-term deficit reduction plan, but not to create new spending programs. That should be done through the regular process so people have an opportunity to look at it and to weigh in. And that's why I'm very leery of a secret farm bill suddenly being dropped into the supercommittee process that won't be subject to any scrutiny or any amendments.
But in the end, it was all for naught. On the Monday before the Thanksgiving deadline, the committee announced, quote, "After months of hard work and intense deliberations, we have come to the conclusion today that it will not be possible to make any bipartisan agreement available to the public before the committee's deadline," end quote. The group had not been able to get past the original differences of spending cuts versus increased taxes. In the meantime, creation of the 2012 Farm Bill will go back to the traditional channels through the House and Senate Agriculture Committees. Although leadership of those committees have said they will use the framework created for the supercommittee as a starting point. I'm Bob Meyer.
In 2011, many in agriculture were keeping a close eye on developments that they believed could pose a threat to GPS systems used by farmers. Brownfield's Ken Anderson has more.
The issue involves a company called LightSquared, which wants to build a 4G wireless broadband network with 40,000 new cell phone towers in rural areas. Agricultural officials say that would push farmers' GPS systems further down the spectrum band, compromising movements across their fields. LightSquared's position is that GPS band users are extending into the band licensed to LightSquared. During an appearance in Iowa in the summer, the administrator of USDA's Rural Utilities Service, Jonathan Adelstein, said the issue was being discussed at the highest levels of the federal government. He says the problem is a shortage of bandwidth.
Do you see what's happening with iPhones and the explosion of uses on video and wireless, that in the future we're not going to have enough spectrum if we don't do something to get more available out there? So how do you not interfere with current uses while getting more broadband out is an issue that both the FCC and the Department of Commerce are now struggling with, and this is one of the very issues.
As the year comes to a close, negotiations on the issue continue. The matter is unresolved. The FCC will ultimately decide whether LightSquared can proceed with its broadband plan. I'm Ken Anderson reporting.
This is 2011, the year in review from Brownfield Ag News. It is a question of money, but the National Ag Statistics Service continues to count. Here's Brownfield's John Perkins.
The next USDA Census of Agriculture is right around the corner. Cynthia Clark, administrator of the department's National Agricultural Statistics Service, was at NAFB Trade Talk 2011 and outlined what NASS expects.
Well, we're working to get a lot of interest in the Census of Agriculture. It will be mailed out in December 2012. We want to encourage our farmers and ranchers, particularly the small farmers, to make sure that they are on our census list. But during this year, we are completing our preparations. We mailed the Census of Agriculture December 2012, but we have to print it first. So we're working on getting our printing contract in place. We will be finalizing our mail list, and we do another screening survey to make sure that the list contains farm operators and not people who just have an interest in farming. And we are doing a coverage study in June to make sure that we have a complete census.
Clark added that the service has had to scale back the number of reports that they issue.
It's expected that the USDA overall will take some serious budget reductions. It looks like we're going to get nearly full funding for the census, but our other programs are taking an 11% cut. And we had to review all of our programs to make some difficult decisions as to what we might change. We reviewed all of our programs and identified what we call our core programs.
Later in the year, the National Ag Statistics Service did announce they'll be cutting fewer than expected reports.
2011 produced a lot of anxiety over federal government regulatory overreach. The president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, Bob Stallman, says the biggest threat facing American agriculture isn't related to farm policy or trade policy. Stallman says the biggest threat is the current regulatory climate in the U.S.
It just seems like there's a continual stream of regulations and proposed regulations that are once again looking for a problem to solve that maybe even doesn't exist on the farm, and yet they're being applied to agriculture, sometimes with nefarious intentions of those who don't believe that modern agricultural production should exist as it is, and then other times I think it's just a blind lack of knowledge about what conditions exist on a farm and ranch.
Stallman says the proposed changes to federal child labor laws are the latest example of federal overreach. One of the stories from 2011 that not only raised eyebrows, but for many in agriculture, raised their blood pressure as well. Here's more from Brownfield's Dave Russell.
We're talking about the proposed changes to child labor laws and how it affects the type of work young people can do on the farm. Now, those in favor of the changes point out that it has been 40 years since changes have been made. In an interview back in October with Dee Jepson, State Extension Safety Leader at The Ohio State University, Dee told Brownfield that while an exemption in the law that allows children to work on farms owned and operated by their parents remain in place, the exemption goes away simply because of how we define the farm structure today.
And I think it really brought light to something that has not been talked about or has been changed for nearly 40 years ago. And that gets to the heart of some of our farm family structure, like our farms that have children working for them. Our regulations that we're currently working under calls it a parent exemption. Well, that's always been there, but as we look at how the farm has changed over the years, especially in the last 40 years, perhaps the parents aren't the ones that are actually doing the day-to-day management of those farms. They may not even have full ownership of the farms, that there could be, you know, truly an uncle, an aunt, or a grandparent that's managing that. And so when we read into what the proposed changes are for the youth, what's really kind of a side issue is this whole idea of how family farms have changed. And perhaps this is a great opportunity for us then to change a law that is no longer really affecting a family farm.
2011 also brought some apparent conclusion to the GPSA rule that was released by the USDA in December. It imposes new regulations on meat companies, but it's far less sweeping than the initial proposal that ran into strong opposition from many livestock groups, meat packers, and from Congress. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says the rule will be helpful to farmers, but he admits it could have been even stronger if Congress had not intervened. Farm groups and activists who pushed for more regulations also wish that the rule would have gone further. RCAF USA spokesman Bill Bullard says USDA bowed to the pressure of the meat packers and their allies. But most industry analysts seem to agree that the scaled-back GPSA rule is a victory for the nation's biggest meat packers, assuring them continued flexibility in dealing with poultry and livestock producers. As of the end of 2011, VTEC will have expired. That's the ethanol tax break. But some say it's no longer needed. That's according to the head of POET, the nation's largest ethanol production company. Jeff Broyne told reporters in December that it's been enormously helpful in building the ethanol industry, but ethanol production has become increasingly efficient in the process. Broyne cautions that Congress needs to keep the renewable fuel standard in place and must continue to invest in cellulosic ethanol production, which has yet to reach commercial scale. Another thing at the end of 2011 will be the expiration of the biodiesel tax incentive. The $1 per gallon incentive lapsed in 2010 that caused biodiesel production to plummet. The incentive was reinstated at the start of 2011, resulting in record biodiesel production nearly triple to the 2010 amount. At the beginning of this year, the EPA approved the higher blend rate for ethanol, E15. It was approved in January of this year, and some were predicting that E15 would be available to motorists by fall or early winter. Growth Energy CEO Tom Bias says there has been progress, but some regulatory hurdles remain.
We're waiting on the final approval of the fuel registration. We had to submit health effects testing on the difference between E10 and E15 and what comes out of the tailpipe. We're waiting for EPA to grant us the approval of that so we can register the fuel.
E15 usage will be restricted to model year 2001 and newer vehicles. Bias says that's about 70% of the vehicles on the road today. As we continue our year in review, 2011, one of the voices most frequently heard on Brownfield Ag News is that of John Perkins, who reports daily on commodity futures prices. So we're going to talk to him about what has been driving these prices this year. John, what took place in there? What drove these?
Really, Tom, it comes back to two things. You've got the fundamentals, the supply and demand outlooks for all of your individual commodities. You know, how much is there and how much do people want? And then you've got the outside market influence, which was arguably a bigger influence across the commodity pits this year. We saw a lot of world economic uncertainty, both in China's growth and in concerns over Europe's debt, not to mention the stuff that continues stateside. And, you know, a lot of money came out of stock markets and went into even some of the non-traditional commodities like gold and crude oil. Really, it was a pretty strong year all around for those in the commodity game.
But that didn't last the whole year, John. We did see some relaxation of these prices, some softening of these futures markets since their peak in the summer. What happened there?
Well, on one hand, you had yet another shift in the outside markets as Europe became a larger and larger deal as the year went on, and traders definitely wanted to reduce their risk exposure in a lot of these commodity markets. However, fundamentally, maybe the corn and soybean crops this year were a little bit larger than expected, and really you don't see much demand for wheat on the international market right now, and that definitely served to trim the prices a little bit. And when you get into the cattle and hog futures, there are enough concerns about consumer demand and the spending power of the dollar that, you know, a lot of traders felt it was necessary to remove some of the risk there, too.
Thank you, John Perkins. Heard daily on Brownfield's commodity markets. Another person we hear several times a day in the livestock markets, Jerry Passer. Jerry, tell us how the hog market has done this year.
Oh, Tom, this has been one of the most interesting years, I think, in a long time for the hog market. We've seen record prices several times throughout the year. And I think the one thing that we really need to talk about when it comes to hogs is the export market. You know, last spring we saw they kept talking about the grilling season not gearing up the way it should have because of the cold, wet weather. We didn't see anything around Memorial Day like we normally do. And so that was, you know, people talking about that all the time, about the domestic demand. Yet we saw high hog prices, and one of the reasons was exports. Exports have just been on fire this year and have really fueled that hog market. During October alone, we were up 42% compared to a year ago. Pork imports were down 11%, and we exported 413 million pounds more pork than we imported. So October was the 199th consecutive month that U.S. pork exports exceeded the imports. So the first 10 months of 2011, up 22.8%. So that's really what has fueled that pork market as we've gone through the year 2011, Tom.
Can we say that the export markets have been just as friendly to cattle producers?
Yeah, they've been really friendly to the cattle producer, too. Beef exports during October were up 10.7% compared to a year ago. Imports were down 4.4% for the first 10 months of the year, 2011. Exports up 25.4%. And, the economy, the way it's been in the United States, the demand has been down, but the export markets have pretty much kept things afloat. Now, it seems like, cattle producers should be making money, but they are still losing per head. And the big reason for that is we've also seen those, really high corn prices. The inputs have been very, very high. Now, as we take a look to 2011, I think we're going to see things continue on pretty much the, or I should say 2012, things continue pretty much on the same plane with prices higher going into the summer months. And it all, again, depends on grain prices. But I think things are pretty rosy for the future in cattle and hogs.
Jerry, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Hey, Tom, you have a great 2012.
You're listening to 2011, the year in review from Brownfield Ag News.
My name is Pat Westhoff, and I'm the director of the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri. It's been a positive year for much of U.S. agriculture. We've seen higher commodity prices across the board for most crop and livestock commodities. While input costs have gone up, it's been a relatively good year for farm income. We're looking perhaps a record net farm income in 2011.
Let's get into specifics here. First, as far as farm income is concerned, what was it that was responsible for record farm income in 2011?
And it's primarily the higher prices for the major crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, higher prices for cattle, hogs, and other livestock categories as well. So that combination means a lot higher value for what farmers sell. While cost of production also increased, it didn't increase as much as cost did, prices did this year.
Of course, we had some trouble. The growing season was considerably tough, and I think that farmers surprisingly had a pretty good harvest in spite of that. However, there was reduced production, and that kind of put upward pressure on prices as well. So would that have caused the peak in, say, the corn market through the summer?
That's right. If you look back to just the summer of 2010, we had corn prices below $4 a bushel. Now we're looking at a season average price for this market of about $6 per bushel. What's happened over the last couple of years? Is there some big change in the macroeconomy? Is there some big change in the biofuel picture? Not really. It's primarily the fact that we had a smaller than usual corn crop each of the last 2 years in the United States.
Pat Westhoff directs the Food and Agriculture Policy Research Institute. If it weren't for Dairy Brownfield, this network would have no name. Dairy, who uttered the network's first words in January of 1973, died last spring. We dedicate this program to Dairy Brownfield. After all, we'd be nowhere without him. 2011, the Year in Review, is produced with help from John Perkins, Jerry Passer, Bob Meyer, Megan Grevner, Ken Anderson, Andrew McCray, Dave Russell, and Julie Harker. The executive producer is Cindy Young. Thank you for listening. I'm Tom Stever, Brownfield, Ag News for America.